Welcome. My name is Ernie Gates, and I'm going to be the moderator today for ACA's faculty compounding meeting, a webinar. I want to welcome our guest, who is well-known in the compounding world. He's been with his inspection for ACHC. He's had tremendous background, which he's going to follow up and give you his background, so I don't have to lead into that. But I want to welcome you all, and I hope you enjoy this subject matter, because it's something we all take for granted, but he's going to help us understand a little bit more about it. Rad Dillon.
Thank you. Good afternoon or morning, as the case may be. We were just talking about time zones earlier. So today I'm going to talk to you about how to test the validity of the certification reports that sterile and non-sterile compounding pharmacies pretty much have to attain for their facilities and equipment. So I'll be honest with you, I'll be focusing more on sterile than for non-sterile, for the pretty simple reason there are a lot more moving parts to the former than the latter. I'm using the phrase misplaced trust with a question mark for reasons that should become obvious later as we go along. So now I'm going to press my, you would think that pressing down would get me to the next slide. Well, that's interesting. Well, it's not going to do much good if we can't get to the next slide. This good? No. Well, that's the one thing I didn't practice. Interesting. Let's call the moving fly a little bit. Oh, okay. I'll have to do a monitor. All right. So, sorry about that, folks. So, I've been involved in sterile compounding since even before Gideon Pharmacy School, and I was in, I guess you'd call it, oversight positions of one form or another ever since 1986, but about way back in the old Caremark days. So several decades ago, I obtained some American Society for Quality, that's ASQ, certifications as a quality auditor and a Six Sigma Green Belt. I've been a member of the faculty at NHRA's Sterile Compounding Clinic since it began 5 years ago, not counting, of course, the missed COVID year of 2019. So, and then I've been a contract and employee surveyor for ACHC PCAB for 10 years, inspecting about 400, by my best estimate, sterile and non-sterile facilities. During that time, I left them last August because basically the coast-to-coast weekly travel was just getting more than I could stand. So I'm back to being an independent consultant and a data analyst. So by way of disclosure, I'm spending a lot of time as of late as a consultant for Veteran Scientific, which is a small enterprise that mainly works with hospital pharmacy chains doing a couple of things. They review certification reports, and I mean really review them. We tear them completely apart and slowly put them back together again. We also help company-owned pharmacies with engineering controls and their quality control and quality assurance programs. So I've been the understudy, so to speak, of an amazing industrial hygienist whose name is Herschel Hitchcock. I thought I understood certification reports reasonably well in the past. He's taught me just how wrong I was, but I'm catching up. So our scope of concern today is as follows. The secondary engineering controls, SECs, in which sterile compounding occurs. The negative pressure rooms, CSECs, in which sterile or non-sterile hazardous drugs are compounded. And then the primary engineering controls, PEC, found in these rooms in which preparations are actually made. So these rooms and devices must work properly in order to do three very important things. One is, of course, protect patients from contaminated sterile preparations. Two, in the case of hazardous drugs, protect the workers from exposure to them. And three, protect the environment from contamination by hazardous drugs. So ensuring the proper performance of these rooms and devices involves inspection. So there's a long list of yardsticks, that is reference standards, that govern this inspection process. Any certifier who inspects these rooms and devices must comply with the relevant standards on this list and do so correctly. I'm not going to read the list, but I will make a few points. The latest revision of USP 797 concerning sterile compounding removes direct reference to CO standards, but they're still considered a standard of practice to be disregarded at one's peril. You don't want to find yourself in a courtroom being accused of ignoring industry standards of practice, whatever you do in the world. And manufacturer specifications often apply. This is often the case for PECs, such as biological safety catalysts. And just a little hint about things to come. When certifiers test against manufacturer standards, it really helps if they're reading from the correct manufacturer manual. So for sterile SECs, all of these reference standards pretty much boil down to what's shown here. Most of these tests are mandatory. A few, such as verifying the pharmacy's ongoing measurement of temperature, humidity, or does a courtesy to the pharmacy to validate its own routine measurements. Also, some pharmacies perform their own surface sampling. We're seeing a lot more of this since the new revision of 797 requires monthly surface sampling. Some pharmacies even do their own viable air sampling. So all of this applies to clean room suites only. There aren't any testing requirements for segregated compounding areas, that is, places in which a PEC is placed for compounding sterile preps that will have a significantly shorter beyond use dates, BUDs. You mainly see these in so-called satellite hospital pharmacies and some ambulatory infusion suites in which drugs are compounded for almost immediate use. So here's a list of tests for primary engineering controls involving sterile compounding. There's a lot of overlap with the secondary, but the tests are often conducted somewhat differently. So before moving on, let's step back and think a bit about the criticality of inspection. So doing it right the first time may be the goal, certainly, but inspection still plays a really critical role. So here's a short list of some recent disasters, at least recent for me. While the root causes of these events vary, they all have one thing in common. Proper inspection would have prevented all of them. So I'll soon be updating the slide to include Boeing's recent near disaster when the side panel flew off of one of its planes. Regardless of the final report, however, one thing we've already found out, that proper inspection would have prevented this event too. So I kind of had Al Gore's video, An Inconvenient Truth, in mind when I named this section. So the inconvenient truth is as follows. The aviation industry, for example, outsources many of their inspections to third parties. Nothing wrong with that per se, but at least they have the internal expertise to understand the reports that result. Very few pharmacies have enough internal expertise to fully understand the certification process or the resulting reports. I don't mean to imply that many PICs out there and now designated persons, who sometimes are often the same person, can't read through a report reasonably well. But as I alluded to earlier, I found out there's a lot more than meets the eye. So even if a pharmacy does, they seldom have the time for such detailed reviews. But that's exactly what sterile compounders expected to do based on this passage from the new revised 797. So, quote, all certification and recertification records must be reviewed by the designated person or persons to ensure that classified environments meet the minimum requirements of this chapter. So as Hamlet would say, here's the rub. In other walks of life, we pay good money to experts to inspect things we don't have the expertise or the time to do ourselves. You know, that can include radiologists, primary care physicians, CPAs, the list goes on. We expect them to act as professionals and in fact perform such tasks in a professional manner. Compounding pharmacies expect the same from those who inspect and certify their facilities. But is the trust justified? I'm going to let you draw your own conclusions after a few more slides. So Kershaw, who I alluded to earlier, and I have developed a list of 10 error types that we're calling error A through error J, that apply to certification reports. So I'm going to present you with a few examples of such errors. By the way, I've concealed the identity of the pharmacy or the certifier as needed, although we have their permissions to use these examples. So here's an example of error H. Information upon which calculations are based is incorrect or not shown. These are snapshots from one report for two PECs of the exact same make and model. Yet one's apparently 19% larger than the other. It doesn't work that way. Like everything from trucks to toasters, the same model is the same size with a tolerance of maybe a few millimeters. They don't vary by 20%. So this directly impacts a number of important calculations. By the way, it turns out that the correct size is shown for PEC2. Here's another example of error H. Note that the heights of the ante room, the buffer room, and the negative pressure buffer room grow by a foot from room to room. That's fairly interesting in itself, as in reality, they're all 9 feet high. So since room volume is used to determine the error changes per hour, ACPHs, this error has a significant impact on the calculations. So here we have an example of three error types, all crammed on one page. Error G, not reporting results correctly or fully. There's no way the technician took 160 readings. If he or she did, this would be an incredible waste of time. Probably take more than a full day anyway. Error A, not using the proper reference standards. For this particular PEC, the range of error velocity should be 80 to 100, not 90 to 110, as is shown. Error D is in David, not conducting tests properly. So per Herschel's notes here, he likes to make notes on the reports. This PEC has no exhaust volume, so this is completely inappropriate. And the same for the error capture in this type of hood. And I'm trying to go down to the next slide. Yeah, everything was working fine before this. Why is it not deciding to go? Let's see what else I could do. Why should it suddenly stop working? Well, let's see if that works. Oh, okay. There's more than one way to do this. That's actually easier for me. But there's more, and so it's on the same page. So this page was really crammed with great examples. Error I, not reporting all information needed to assess the report's validity. In this case, equipment calibration information is not present. Error H, information upon which calculations are based is incorrect or not shown. In this case, individual velocity readings are not present. So why is this important? Without calibration dates, we can't be sure if the equipment was in fact suitable for, excuse me. I thought I had silenced my phone. Why is this important? Without calibration dates, we can't be sure if the equipment was in fact suitable for use. And sometimes, by the way, it's not.
Sorry.
Sorry about that, folks. Okay, and now, without the raw data used to make calculations, we can't check the math. And yes, the math can be wrong. Quite often, it seems to be wrong. So here's an example of error B, not applying reference standards correctly. So the error changes per hour from the biological safety cabinet, the BSC, are counted towards the room's total ACPHs. You may recall on a prior slide, we talked about that you can't do that. Now this is fine in some cases, but not for sterile hazardous drug compound, when the output from the BSCs must be completely exhausted, so therefore it can't count toward the total. Now for two more examples of error A, not using the proper reference standard. So this report cites as one of its reference standards a standard that was obsoleted 23 years ago. Down below, the certifier has unilaterally decided to use a significantly more lenient standard, CAG or CAG, or people pronounce it differently. Standard 003 requires that leaks not exceed 0.01% of the upstream challenge versus the 0.03%, which is significantly more lenient. And here's another example of ARA. This is a very common issue. The average particle count is used to determine the isoclass of a room. But CAG003 has been out there since October of 2022, and it requires the maximum number to be used. And ISO 14644-1, another applicable standard, also requires this, and it's been in effect since 2015. So this is an important change that should have been immediately adopted by certifiers. Okay, so we're calling this error X because we don't want to openly accuse a certifier of falsifying or massaging the numbers, but you can decide for yourself. So these sets of readings were from the same PEC on two successive inspections, 6 months apart. So the range of readings in the first set is 20. This makes sense. The range of readings the second time on a handwritten document that's not been entered into the software is only 6. Well, HEPA filters are amazing things, but they don't get better with time in this sense. So this is a very narrow range of numbers anyway, kind of an unbelievably narrow range. So we suspect that the numbers were either massaged so as to pass the unit, or perhaps they weren't actually taken at all the second time. Some numbers were pulled out of thin air later after the technician left the building. So there are some other serious issues, as we'll call them, out there that we've not classified as errors per se. It's common to see certifiers squeak by doing the minimum amount of work when reference standards left them. Our reference standards don't even exist. So one example is taking one viable air sample in a 12-foot by 13-foot buffer room. That's a big room. Only taking one sample is really pushing the limit. And in at least the case I'm thinking about, the sample was taken inside the PEC, not out in the room, which of course is going to be far less likely to go anything than a sample in the room. I mean, we're talking class 5 versus class 7 air. There's a 100-fold difference in the number of particles in the air. So the same thing happens with surface sampling. Often seen one sample in a large room. Seriously, I mean, one sample is called an anecdote. So there's also a lot of what I call going through the motions. So here are some examples. All airflow readings within a PEC are exactly the same. What are the chances of that? And sometimes you'll also see identical airflow readings for the same exact HEPA filter on two successive reports, again, separated by 6 months. So you'd be more likely to win the Mega Millions lottery than for this to actually occur. It's just not going to happen. So these issues and other ones like them might have dire consequences. Patients might receive contaminated preparations when the pharmacy has no reason to suspect that there were any problems. They're assuming their certification report was correct and passed them. Employees might be exposed to NIOSH list hazardous drugs, again, when the pharmacy trusted that the certifier was doing its job. Whether or not these conditions actually existed, one of the first things a smart litigating attorney would probably do is ask for copies of certification reports. So the results, needless to say, could be very, very bad, again, regardless of the pharmacy's actual status. They might be thinking they're doing the right thing. So let me ask the question again, is such trust justified concerning the certification process? I'll now ask you to draw your own conclusions based on the slides we've just been looking at. I'll include a quote from my good friend. Some of the audience may know him, Mike Regas, very long-term veteran in the sterile compounding world. I thought his quote was perfect. Almost every report I ever read had something ambiguous or wrong with it. Now, you know, anyone can make mistakes, including inspectors. We get that. Yeah, I guess what most disturbs me as I dig deeper and deeper into the certification process is candidly the cavalier attitude that is found in so many, not all, but so many of these certifiers. It's basically a betrayal of the trust in the place of these organizations. So what's the designated person that USP 797 and 795 governing non-sterile and 800 governing hazardous drugs expect to be responsible for overseeing these certification process. What are they to do? So I thought of Ronald Reagan's famous quote from decades ago now about negotiating an arms reduction treaty with the Soviet Union. Trust but verify. By the way, when I was looking that up, I found it was actually an old Russian proverb. So I thought that was kind of embarrassing. But so that's kind of, I think, very appropriate to apply to this process. So here's a combined list of the tests that must occur for SCCs and PECs. May as well just put them all together. So I'm going to give you a short list of ways to check up on what your certifier does. Okay, so let's start with the basics. If your reports don't include this information, you can always sense trouble ahead. The make and model, serial number, and calibration date of the equipment used during certification must be reported. This isn't a should or would you please, it is required. Also required is a diagram that includes the following: the location of all the sealing HEPA filters that they're going to be testing, the locations that viable particle counts are taken, the correct locations of all PECs, doors, pass-through chambers. I recently reviewed a report that the diagram was very impressive. The only problem was the PEC was shown on the completely opposite wall where it had been moved about 2 years previously, and the diagram hadn't been updated. Obviously, the location of something as big as a PEC is going to affect airflow and all the readings. And then finally, the reported and actual dimensions of the rooms. I thought this would be the most no-brainer thing in these reports, but I continue to run into cases in which, you know, they don't have to be absolutely exact, but they better agree with the reality within at least a few percentage points. Because again, a lot of calculations use them, to arrive at results. So it's common for certification reports to not include all the information needed to even decide if they're correct or not. So when I'm evaluating some of these reports, unfortunately, sometimes I'm having to say inconclusive because I don't even have the information to decide if it's right or not. So here's an example. If all the air velocity readings for each HEPA filter aren't present, well, you can't verify the calculations, and you can't determine if they were using the average or maximum value. You may recall a few slides back, they better be using the maximum value, not the average. So the designated person or the PIC or some other responsible person must be given a hard copy or an e-version of the preliminary report before the certifier leaves the building. You know, it's okay to say, hey, I just emailed the link to you, review it this evening. This will prevent the after-the-fact massaging of numbers, which I pretty much guarantee I showed you an example of early on. Now, also, if there are any significant findings, those have to be verbally discussed with somebody before the certifier leaves. I mean, even if it's just the senior pharmacist on duty or the senior tech on duty at the time the certifier is there, they really need to go on record about something that is a point of concern. And then the final report, which would include the microbiology results, the air and surface sample results, should be provided within 21 days of the certification visit. I'm using should there versus must because you want to give a little leeway, and this isn't written in stone, but it's certainly a good best practice. And then to finish this list off, the certifiers must properly clean and disinfect the equipment they bring into your facility. You got to watch some of them like hawks and make sure that they're going to subject their equipment. And I wouldn't even let them roll a cart into your facility. Have them use one of your own carts. But they have to disinfect it and clean it just like you would anything else you were bringing in to your facility. And they must comply with your garbing policies and procedures, hand hygiene procedures, all of the above. They're not exempt from that. Okay, so let's move on to airflow measurements, another important aspect. So as I've said, PECs may contribute to the total air changes per hour, as shown here, depending on the ISO air class of the room, but make sure that ceiling-mounted HEPA filters contribute at least 15 of this total. That's written in stone in 797. Now, this might even apply to anti-rooms, or what are called prep rooms, found in some pharmacies that prepare sterile drugs from raw ingredients. They often have a PEC in this room in which to weigh or measure ingredients. I know that's extremely rare in anti-rooms that you might find in other alternate site environments. Okay, the report must state how the aerosol used to test for HEPA filter leaks is introduced. Is it through ceiling ports or wall ports? This is important because it's a very common error for certifiers to use the wrong equipment to take these measurements. But you can't know this unless they tell you how they did it. Okay, the certifier must insist that the maximum number of workers you ever have in your rooms are there during certification. Otherwise, the total particle count measurements are not really valid. I mean, total particle counts go up significantly with the addition of each person in the room. So this is something, of course, you ought to be keeping in mind yourself if you run and operate a sterile facility, but the certifier is kind of like really needs to insist, okay, are you really telling me that this is the most people you ever have in this room? And these workers must be doing things like media fills, blood fingertip testing, and subsequent surface sampling, or simulated compounding of some kind. So as I mentioned earlier, calculations must be based on the maximum particle count. I can't really overemphasize this enough, not the average. It's time for all certifiers to comply with the regulations that have been in effect for almost 10 years. Measuring pressure differentials between rooms is required, but again, it's usually done and it's valuable. And it's good that they do this. If it is done, they should be compared to what the manometers built into the SEC show. That's the whole point, after all, really, of making that measure. Also, it should be clear if the difference between two areas is positive or negative. Might seem obvious, but it's sometimes not done correctly. You would assume that pressure is flowing into a sterile hazardous drug buffer room, but in reality, one report, it wasn't, and an issue wasn't made of that, which is obviously an enormous big deal. And you could tell from the report. The same with temperature humidity. It's not required, but it's a good way to validate the pharmacy's readings. Okay, a certifier should, you notice I said should, not must, ask you if you made any significant changes to your SECs, like moving a PC to another wall or maybe introducing a new table or a set of shelving. If you have done that, you have to do smoke studies to verify proper workflow. And actually, you should be notifying the certifier before you make such changes, or not make them until just before your scheduled certification visit. Smoke studies must always be performed inside each PEC, and workers must be simulating compounding activities while this happens, or again, it's basically a waste of time. Videotaping is optional, but it's best done by you if you do it. Unless the certifier volunteers to do so, some do. If it's done, you should require all your workers, especially new ones, to view the videotapes. It's critical to understand the airflow in each particular PEC. They're not all created exactly the same way. And you have different kinds of equipment inside some of your PCs. Okay, so there are no requirements as to how many places you should conduct viable air sampling. And as you've seen, some certifiers exploit this by doing the bare minimum, and that would be one. Thus, for any but the tiniest anteroom, these numbers are going to be something more than one. Yes, you need to do air and surface samplings within PECs, but the certifier can't count these towards the totals for a room. The numbers and locations of these samples should be based upon risk assessments that you or an independent consultant have performed. Okay, so fortunately, the language of the newly revised 797 now only requires the identification of microbes that you find during viable air or surface sampling if the number of colony-forming units, CFUs, exceed the action levels established for each type of isoclass air. That's a very helpful new development. So those action levels are shown here for air and surface sampling, respectively. So by the way, if the CFUs reported by the microbiology lab your certifier uses are always just below the action levels, you should be suspicious. There's a real temptation to pass you, and you would probably want to verify those numbers. Also, if your CFU counts have been doing great, but then you suddenly get a very high reading, you should immediately suspect plate contamination. Don't panic. Order an immediate retest or do one yourself. it's probably not a sudden catastrophic issue with your room. You can't rule it out, but it's probably not. Another, by the way, many, if not most, vanity rooms are ISO class A. So note the very high action levels allowed for such air, 100. So observation number one, if you're running CFU counts in the, let's say, the 70s or 80s in your vanity room, I'm proposing that you have a serious problem, even though you're well below the action level. So observation number two, you better be trending your CFU counts, and not just because 797 now tells you that you must. As this hypothetical graph shows, you might still be well below the action level, but you're heading for a serious problem. Why are the counts steadily rising every 6 months after every 6 months? This trending was stipulated in the prior version of 797, but the language was a little ambiguous. Trending involves more than just a quick comparison of your current report to a report 6 months ago. You really need to graph it. Unfortunately, we're not aware of any current microbiology lab who is trending such data. Hey, if yours does, please let me know. They need to be commended. So the burden will probably fall on you. Hopefully, somebody has enough Excel skills that they can create a reasonably good graph that you can use. So to wrap things up, I've only presented you with a handful of suggestions, but they're based on some good suspicions of what's likely to go wrong, what we're seeing going wrong on reports, and things that are pretty disturbing if they do. But they're only the tip of the iceberg in terms of what might be wrong in a certification report or the certification process. But like any sampling process, they should give you a pretty good assessment of your certification. So now let's talk about what happens if you find some issues of concern based on what I presented on earlier slides. How does your certifier react when you contact them? Do they act condescending, basically telling you that you just don't understand the process, or are they constructive and helpful? Do they try to fog you citing various reference standards or whatever? Or do they patiently explain things to you in a way that you can understand? If there are obvious errors or omissions, like I said earlier, nobody's perfect, this happens. Do they openly admit that they screwed up, or do they try to dismiss the issue as unimportant? So also, you need to self-assess yourself. Maybe your regular certification tech is a wonderful human being, but are they doing what they must do and doing it right? Good bedside manner, so to speak, doesn't guarantee confidence. But if you encounter any of the second set of responses to these questions, it's time to hit the panic button and get some help. One of the beauties of a free enterprise economy, which we live in, is there's always an alternative vendor out there, or there's a consultant out there that can help you. So I moved kind of fast, wanted to get through. And that's all, folks. Are there any questions or comments? I know we have a relatively limited live audience at this time, but what the heck?
Rad, I have a comment though. It's you really got into the intricacies of something that I don't think I may be wrong, but enough folks know about these numbers to check on, and you brought that really through the intricacies and articulated it very well, because at least we get a response of what to look for, because there's a what you showed is something we all, well, at least we take for granted, that we have to try to understand. A lot of us are not in that engineering category, but I'm sure our audience here can elaborate or ask questions further. But that's my comment, and I thank you for at least articulating that, and I hope that somewhere along the line, when you have these certifiers come in, that you can have a way of checking them out first and trying to make sure that they're the right people, a right company.
A very good point. And you know, I didn't present you all with a checklist per se, but hopefully, you know, you could extrapolate that from the slides and people can make up their own. And I think it's kind of important. It's human nature, right? There's nothing that focuses the mind more than the statement, after the presentation, there will be a test, or after the activity. So, I mean, it's only natural that if certifiers, even ones who are trying to do their best, you know, notice you there with a little checklist, checking things off as they do or do not do things. I think it's inevitable it's going to result in some better attention to detail. Anything else from anyone? If, you know, for the benefit of future listeners or viewers, I have my email on there if anybody wants to reach out with me, to me, and I encourage people to do so. Hope the presentation will be of some help to folks.
Red, one final question though is there such a thing as a check sheet that's available?
Well, I mean, I've made up my own, but it's part of a really big Excel spreadsheet because, you know, like I alluded to, hey, you need to check all those air velocity readings from the HEPA filter. So, I mean, I literally do. I list the whole grid. I make sure what the average is, what the maximum is. I do the calculations. But that's a big spreadsheet. I'm not aware of anybody. I'm sure somebody's developed some sort of a little checklist. And if I knew of who had a good one, I would be referencing them right now.
Are these slides available for the folks that are listening?
I believe they will be.
Because that you can at least get some reference points off of the slides.
Right. Yeah, I mean, go ahead.
They will be because they're actually recorded in the presentation.
That's great. That'll be helpful. I guess that's the end of our session, and I want to thank ACA for allowing me to moderate this a great presentation that's extremely helpful, and thank Rad Dillon for making the presentation, which he did a fantastic job on a very difficult subject matter. But thank you all, and I hope this was helpful to the audience.
All right. It's a wrap, I guess.